All right, y'all, welcome to the Scott Horton Show. I am the director of the Libertarian Institute, editorial director of antiwar.com, author of the book Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan, and I've recorded more than 5,000 interviews going back to 2003, all of which are available at scotthorton.org. You can also sign up for the podcast feed. The full archive is also available at youtube.com/Scott Horton Show. All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Matthew Ho from the Center for International Policy. And of course, famously, he was a captain in the U.S. Marine Corps during Iraq War II. And then while working for the State Department in Afghanistan in 2009, he called it quits and blew the whistle and wrote a public letter to General Eikenberry explaining why he was leaving, and in an attempt to stop Obama from approving the David Petraeus surge of really 60,000 more troops, not as many as 90,000 more troops, into the country for the giant failed surge of 2010 through 12 there. And has been a great anti-war activist ever since then, too. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Matthew?
Good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing great. Really appreciate you joining us on the show here today. And so we have really important stuff to talk about. It's a minor point within the major narrative about what's been going on between America and Iran, and that is the role of Iran in supporting Iraqi militias during Iraq War II, Shiite militias during Iraq War II, which militias they were backing and to what ends and when and how, and especially, of course, the narrative of the EFP, explosively formed penetrator, copper core, roadside bombs that were so effective against American armored vehicles and killing American soldiers who were fighting against the Shia there. And while this discussion was going on in the last week, you had made a comment about this. And so I wanted to have you on to talk about what you know about this story.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you know, this is nothing new in the sense of you know, waving the bloody shirt, so to speak, to try and rally the cause for war. You know, I mean, this was certainly done against the Native Americans over and over again, you know, that the claims that the Native Americans were committing atrocities. So we had to, you know, handle those savages. You know, it's certainly, you know, Gulf of Tonkin, you know, with Vietnam. I mean, we could sit here all day and just go back and forth. But yeah, I mean, the latest thing, of course, with Iraq and Iran is that General Soleimani, who was assassinated by the United States last week, was responsible for the deaths of 600 Americans in the Iraq War, because he is Shia, and those 600 troops were killed by Shia militias. It's a simple math for the administration, for the war hawks, for the Pentagon to just conflate the two. Of course, it's much more complicated than that. But it's, you know, it's bunk. I mean, the main thing, the main point about it, if you know, I start off on the top of it is if you're going to say that Soleimani and the Iranians are responsible for what the Shia militias did in Iraq, then you have to say that the Saudis and the other Gulf countries are responsible for what the Sunni insurgents did in Iraq. I mean, this has been confirmed by WikiLeaks. But also, too, you know, from my time in Iraq and at the State Department, at the Pentagon, funding sources for the Iraqi Sunni insurgents were coming from the Gulf countries. Were they coming directly from, you know, the Saudi military headquarters in Riyadh? No, there's no evidence of that. But just the same as there is no hard evidence, you know, there's no receipt for a transfer of funds between the Iranian military and any of the Shia militias. Were the Iranians involved? Yes. But to what degree? You know, probably at a significant level less than the Saudis were involved. And the same thing goes, too, with you know, to the east of Iran, to the east and north of Iran and Afghanistan. The Iranians were not involved in an insurgency at all, although at various times both the Obama administration and the Trump administration have accused Iran of being involved in the insurgencies there, which is just complete, you know, complete bullshit, you know, I mean, for lack of a better term. I mean, the obscenity of this administration and of previous administration doesn't earn the respect, I think, of polite words or of words that are not offensive. So, you know, in Afghanistan, we knew that the Taliban had 4 or 5 funding streams. And one of them, and in some ways it was the chief funding stream, was monies coming in from the Persian Gulf, from the Sunni countries, from Saudi Arabia, from the Qataris, from UAE, from Kuwait, from Bahrain, et cetera, as well as, of course, from the Pakistanis. And this, too, has been confirmed by WikiLeaks. So I'm not, you know, I'm not shedding any intelligence that hasn't already been done by Chelsea Manning. But, you know, it's important to keep that in mind. If we're going to point the finger at Iran, then, you know, we're being hypocritical, as we seemingly always are, in not looking at who was funding the insurgents that killed the preponderance. Look, about 4,400, I think it was 4,400 Americans were killed in Iraq. You know, so almost 4,000 of them were killed by Sunni insurgents who were, again, backed by the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Qataris, et cetera. And in Afghanistan, all of our soldiers have been killed by Sunni, you know, insurgent groups, by the Taliban, by Hezbi Islami, Gulbuddin, by the Haqqani Network, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, this notion of pointing the finger at Iran is just absolute. But again, it goes in line with, you know, whether it's the Spanish-American War, the Vietnam War, the Mexican War, the war against Native Americans. You know, I mean, that there has to be a reason for. The first time I remember ever seeing anything like this when I was a kid was in William Shire's book on Nazi Germany. I think it was called The Rise and Fall of Nazi Germany or whatever it was called.
The Third
Reich. The Third Reich. That's right. And what he talked about in there, which I had never heard, was that to start off the invasion of Poland, supposedly the Nazis, whether it was the army or the Gestapo or whoever, took out a bunch of prisoners, shot them, dressed them up in Polish uniforms, put them on the German side of the border, and then brought the German press and international press out and say, look, the Poles attacked us, so we're responding. You know what I mean? So this is pretty much common for any country who has desires to attack another to try and create some reason for it, some causes belli, I guess, as you would say, if we're talking just war doctrine.
And so going back to 2007, in the height of the surge, the dismissal of Rumsfeld, the rise of Gates and Petraeus, a major part of the surge was the redirection. Now we're mad that we just fought this whole El Salvador option for the supermajority that we put in power that's disregarding us. So now we're going to blame Sauder, even though really it's in terms of American goals of limiting Iranian influence, seem kind of counterproductive to prefer the Dawa party and Skiri to Sauder, but there it is, because he wanted us out and Iran out. So there was the wrinkle there. So they targeted him and started backing the Sunnis right at this time. And there was a huge push. They even abandoned all the talking points about the nuclear program for like half a year. It's like they completely forgot about all their nuclear lies so that they could propose strikes inside Iran at IRGC bases, supposedly for their intervention in Iraq and supplying all of these EFP bombs, Matthew.
Yeah. You know, quickly with Sauder, a friend of mine, Teron Sims, who was with a cavalry unit that was stationed in Sauder City in 2003, he was at his squadron, you know, was in the area where Sauder lived and where Sauder worked. And he came in and he came in and talked to the Americans in early 2003, in the summer of 2003. And, you know, Teron will tell you how we treated Sauder. That just like You know, I mean, again, history repeating itself, whether it be Ho Chi Minh or whoever, we had an opportunity, Castro. I mean, we had an opportunity to work with Castro in 59 and 60 into 61. You know, I mean, like we've had opportunities to work with people who we then pushed aside because for some reason, like you said, we're favoring Skiri. And so Sauter was somebody who came in, tried to work with us. We treated him roughly. We tore down in the area because we had no idea what we were doing in Sauter City. Among many Muslims, but in particular among Shia, there are banners that they hang often in respect to their dead. We just randomly went through Sauter City and tore these banners down. And these are basically mourning banners, you know, as other and also banners of other religious significance. And then we threw Sauter in jail. And so that's the evolution of how Sauter goes to start to fight us, you know, and start to rebel against our occupation. He was not right off the bat calling for arms against the United States.
You guys,
but then again,
sorry, just to clarify, you and not you personally, but the Marines arrested him in 2003.
The Army arrested him.
The Army arrested. I guess I had missed that. I knew that they had tried to shut down his paper in 2004 was what led to the riot and the fighting in Najaf and all that. But I didn't know that he'd already been in and out of jail by then. God dang it.
Yeah, we had to, I mean, basically had put him under custody for, I think it was only for an evening. But hey, that's the whole point of it.
For a guy like him, that's like arresting Tony Soprano and treating him like, you know, some vagrant or whatever kind of thing. You're going to have some hard feelings after that, buddy.
And then, and it shows too. We had no idea who this man was. We had no idea. And I use we, you know, and I know almost everyone who's listening right now is not supportive of the war, is not, you know, I just use we because it's the colloquialism that's easiest.
Well, and you were part of the armed forces at the time, so it's okay for you to speak
absolutely.
We because you're like kind of taking responsibility for your higher ups' decisions here and the way you're phrasing it, kind of. But we understand what you mean.
And we're going to get to the EFPs in a minute, but I've got a story of my own to share about how this evolves with the Shia militias, where I was personally involved with the evolution of that. But yeah, we have no idea who Sauter is. We really have no idea. I mean, it's called Sauter City. This man comes in whose name is Sauter, and the connection is not made, let alone the fact that the importance of his father, who was killed by Saddam Hussein, and then we don't even know what these banners are that are hanging outside of people's homes, outside of people's apartments. We have no idea what the purposes of them are. We have no idea what their message is. We have no idea the significance of them. I mean, it'd be the same as going to somebody's house and smashing, you know, urns with cremated remains in them or kicking over gravestones or doing something like that. You know, I mean, and so here we are. We're supposed to, again, rely upon American intelligence. I remember I had a friend of mine, an Iraqi friend of mine who worked with us. We used to have these pamphlets that told us about Iraqi culture and traditions and everything. And this was about 16 months into the occupation. And he said, I remember Amar said to me, he said, I totally understand why you guys are so bad at this. You have no idea about anything, but you think you know. Because this pamphlet that supposedly was meant to tell soldiers about customs and traditions and how to speak and interact with Iraqis and everything was just full of garbage, full of like basically mythology and rumors and innuendos and things that like may have been true in 15th century Baghdad, but certainly weren't true in, you know, 2003, 2004 Baghdad. You know, I mean, and so getting to my little story, which I've shared with you before, Scott, about Skiri and the Badr Corps. Skiri, that's the it stands for the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq. And all throughout Saddam Hussein's time have been based out of, or not all through, but they evolved, I think, in 1983, 1984, around maybe. But they have been based out of Iran and have been used as kind of an agency of Iran within Iraq. And it was all Iraqis who were a part of the group to try and, you know, foster dissent, to try and cause problems for Hussein's regime, to maybe hopefully one day overthrow and then have a vehicle to insert people into the government that are aligned with Iran. And we gave them that. The United States gave them that. So when I got to Iraq in the spring of 2004, and I was on a State Department team at that time, and I was a part of the very end of the Coalition Provisional Authority, CPA, which was Paul Bremer's organization. that had control of Iraq for the first year. This was really the colonial administration before we gave Iraq its sovereignty, you know, which was all just, again, just you know, certainly just in name only. But each of the ministries, each of the parts of the Iraqi government were given out to various sects within Iraq, and Skiri had a dominant role among those sects. And when I got there to Iraq, I was supposed to be doing reconstruction. Specifically, I was supposed to be doing work on with the Ministry of Youth and Sport. I was supposed to have I had a $20 million program that was meant to rebuild soccer fields and youth centers and stadiums and, you know, various public works facilities that fall, you know, within the purview of youth and sports. And one day I came into the office in Baghdad, and they said to me, hey, look, you know, that program you're doing, we're no longer doing that. We've transferred your money directly to the ministry, which is $20 million in cash, $100 bills right out of the Federal Reserve, you know, delivered on pallets like you've all seen photos of or videos of or read stories about, you know, and that money was transferred directly to Skiri. And that money, of course, then went right to the Badr Corps, which bought plenty of RPGs and AK-47s and PKMs and whatever else you want to buy. Now, the Badr Corps didn't fight the U.S. so much. I know some guys who did fight the Badr Corps. I've heard from some of them. But primarily the fighting, you know, guys, you know, was with Sadr and some other militias. But it certainly was giving $20 million in cash to the militia that was under the control or aligned with Iran. I mean, so, and this was replicated, this type of transfer of funds, this type of ignorance, this type of just, you know, complete stupidity was replicated one time after another, you know, in Iraq, you know, in Afghanistan, you know, certainly in Libya. Look at Libya. The UN the other day just said like Libya is on the brink of becoming another Syria. And then, of course, Syria, where like the best example of this, right, is when CIA-backed forces in Libya were fighting with Pentagon-backed forces in Syria. CIA-backed forces were fighting with Pentagon-backed forces. You know, I mean, in a sense of that, we just are, forget about the morals, forget about any justification. We are just so extremely incompetent that anything our government says or does should be doubted.
Hold on just one second. Be right back. So you're constantly buying things from Amazon.com. Well, that makes sense. They bring it right to your house. So what you do, though, is click through from the link in the right-hand margin at scotthorton.org, and I'll get a little bit of a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. Won't cost you a thing. Nice little way to help support the show. Again, that's right there in the margin at scotthorton.org. Hey, y'all, check it out. The Libertarian Institute, that's me and my friends, have published three great books this year. First is No Quarter, The Ravings of William Norman Grigg. He was the best one of us. Now he's gone, but this great collection is a truly fitting legacy for his fight for freedom. I know you'll love it. Then there's Coming to Palestine by the great Sheldon Richman. It's a collection of 40 important essays he's written over the years about the truth behind the Israel-Palestine conflict. You'll learn so much and highly value this definitive libertarian take on the dispossession of the Palestinians and the reality of their brutal occupation. And last but not least is the great Ron Paul, the Scott Horton Show interviews 2004 through 2019, interview transcripts of all of my interviews of the Good Doctor over the years on all the wars, money, taxes, the police state, and more. So how do you like that? Pretty good, right? Find them all at libertarianinstitute.org/books. You need stickers for your band or your business? Well, Rick and the guys over at thebumpersticker.com have got you covered. Great work, great prices, sticky things with things printed on them. Whatever you need, thebumpersticker.com will get it done right for you. Thebumpersticker.com. First of all, let me say that I already have a bunch of footnotes from my book about Saudi financing of the Sunni insurgency there, and the CIA complained about it to the Washington Post and at Times and stuff like that. So there's plenty there. But you kind of mentioned personal experience with that, and I was wondering if you could clarify your role at that time and what information that you were seeing about this money that was coming into the Sunni insurgency. What year are we talking about? Everything you can please.
So this would have been 04, 05 in Iraq, where I was on a State Department team based in Tikrit.
You're still a Marine, but you're working under, you know, on a State Department task force type situation.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, at that point, I was a reservist because I had gotten off active duty because I thought I was going to miss. You know, I got off active duty in spring of 04, put my resignation in because you got to put your resignation in months ahead of time. Put my resignation in the summer of 03 because I thought, like many other guys, that I had missed the war. Right. You know, I mean, like, so I shouldn't be saying how incompetent and how ignorant the government is, because I've certainly been that at times, you know. Right. You know, so but.
And
so
you were a captain at that point in the reserves?
I was a captain. Mm-hmm. And so just kind of like a brief time on my mind. But I had a friend of mine. And at this point, I was working as a junior Marine Corps officer on the personal staff of the Secretary of the Navy. And I had a friend, though, who had been shuttled over to the Coalition Provisional Authority to work on human resources. And Ken said to me, hey, would you like to go over to work on Iraq via CPA and then transfer over to the State Department teams and do reconstruction and political stuff? And I said, yeah, that'd be great. And that's how I ended up over there. Spent a year based out of Saddam Hussein's hometown in Tikrit, covering Kirkuk, Diyala province, and also one of the Kurdish provinces, Sulmania. And so after that, I returned back home. After a year there, I went back to the United States, was a consultant for the State Department on the Iraq desk in an organization called the Iraq Policy and Operations Group. Did that for about 5 or 6 months before I had the opportunity to take command of a reserve Marine Corps company and went back to Iraq for 06-07. So I was there during the surge. I was there for the awakening, there for the Sons of Iraq, saw all of that as well. Then too, when I came back home from there, while I was waiting for my appointment into the Foreign Service, I worked for a year for the Joint IED Defense, Joint IED Defeat Organization, or JIDO, a Pentagon, the main Pentagon task force to try and combat IEDs. So everything I know about this is either based off of the intelligence I read, you know, certainly in my State Department spot, and then, throughout, both in Tikrit, and then when I was with the Marine Corps in Anbar, the intelligence on that. But primarily it comes from 04, 05, and then my time at State in 05, and then again at JIDO in 2008. Reading the intelligence on it, reading the known intelligence, as well then too, everything we've known since then, or the absence of information. You know, I mean, one of those things about this idea that the Iranians were behind and everything, we never, there's no smoking gun, right? There's no, where are the documents? Where are the captured? We never captured, an Iraqi who said, yes, Major so-and-so of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps gave us this EFP, or gave us the blueprints for us, or gave us the machinery to make it. None of that exists. And the same way too, the intelligence regarding the Sunnis was all there. We knew it, and this extends into my time in Afghanistan as well, where we knew that the funding, the Afghan insurgency had 4 or 5 funding streams. If I can call off the top of my head, it was the Gulf states, it was the Pakistanis, it was our own contracts, siphoning money off of all the wells and schools and roads we were building. They took a cut from that, as well. Then too, they also took a cut from the drug trade. They were not controlling the drug trade. That was the Afghan government, and it is to a degree still. The Taliban have taken more control of it because they've taken possession of so much of Helmand and Kandahar and other parts. But those were kind of the big funding streams for the Taliban. And again, the chief one, according to the intelligence we had, according to the stuff that I would read that was classified secret and top secret, was that the funding was coming from the Persian Gulf to the Taliban, as well as to in Iraq. The money that was coming in to the insurgency was coming from the Saudis, the Kuwaitis, the Syrians were involved too. And of course, the Libyans sent a lot of guys over to the Libyans, a lot of young men came from Libya to fight us. But still, when you talk about the number of foreign fighters that came to Iraq to fight us, you know, as opposed to the entire insurgency, you know, it was such a small, insignificant amount. 1 or 2%, I believe, were foreign fighters. The rest were all Iraqis who were fighting us, you know. But yeah, I mean, but they were coming, you know, a lot were Saudis, a lot were Yemenis. So that too, there was no Iranians coming over to fight us. They were the people who were coming over to fight us were from our supposed allies, and that's something that it's so disturbing to hear this discussion about that the reason for, you know, I don't know if folks remember in the lead up to 2003, and they're playing with, you know, the administration and the media who's going along with it and all the war hawks are going along with it. They're playing with the lives of 600 families in the United States. Right now, there are 600 families that are reliving their loved ones' deaths, that are going through this, that are having all kinds of spates of emotional convulsions because of this. You know, and it reminds me so much of in the run-up to the invasion, there was a American pilot who had been shot down in the first Iraq war named Michael Spiker, a Navy pilot. And the administration, even though the United States knew he was dead, they went along with rumors and half-assed theories and just complete lies to saying that Spiker was alive and being held in an Iraqi prison. And his family, what his family went through with the hope of that, even though we knew he was dead, even though a Bedouin tribesman had like pulled his body out of the wreckage of the aircraft, we went along with it. And the Washington Post went along with it, and the New York Times went along with it, and CNN went along with it. And the poor Spiker family suffered over and over again until after the invasion when we said, oh no, he's dead. Yeah, and so they're doing the same thing again now with these 600 families of these 600, young men and women who were killed there, by saying it was the Iranians and we are going to get justice for them. It's bullshit. Yeah, and they're not going to but they don't care because the men and women we have in power are psychopaths and sociopaths, and none of it matters. And it was the fact that they would,
the fact that they feel like they got to go back 13 years to come up with an excuse in the first place just goes to show how dishonest the whole enterprise is. But so real quick now, and I'm sorry because we're already over time, but I got to, I'm going to push back the other guy a minute because I got to wrap up a couple things with you. First of all, we know from out here in the world, Gareth Porter's journalism and a great many others, and I wrote a blog entry about this at antiwar.com, linking to all the stuff from back in 2000. I started debunking the stuff back in the spring of 2006. But we have all the links from all the reporting back then that these EFPs were being made in factories in Iraq and that these machine shops and such were found over and over and over and over again. And so quite contrary to what you just said, or not contrary to what you just said, but the thing that you described, where there's no evidence that any of these came from Iran, there's every evidence that they did not come from Iran. And so, but the important part here is you were working for this, how did you say it, JIDO?
Yeah, it's called JIDO. Yeah, the Joint IED Defeat Organization. And it's got a different name now or whatever, but it was the Prime Pentagon Task Force.
But you're talking about in the spring of 2007, for example, is when you were working there?
Well, I was in 2008. I was there in spring of 2007. Okay. I was still in Iraq with the Marines, and I was a combat engineer. So my Marines did route clearance, which meant we went
and
out.
In East Baghdad went, or Najaf or wherever the fight was against the Sadrists and so forth.
We were in Anbar, so we were against the Sunnis. So I never fought against the Shia. But thank God, because we didn't have to face the EFPs, because the EFPs, to give a brief description of it, is it's a concave device, and the inner part of that cavity of the concave, and people can look this up on Google, just Google EFP or explosively formed projectile or explosively formed penetrator, whichever one you want to call it. It has the inside of that is lined with a metal, preferably copper, and then the outside of that cavity is packed with explosives. And so when that device is detonated, what happens is, think of a V, and think of the V collapsing on itself or collapsing inward, and then the force of the explosion, because that's what the explosive is doing, then is redirects forward. And we use these something that's been around for more than 100 years now, at least probably 150 years, the idea of using what's called a shape charge to try and blast a hole in something. You know, if you're doing mining or you're doing bridging or tunneling, or, you know, you're trying to get into something, that's what's called a shape charge. And again, just Google shape charge and you'll find out what this all is. But the idea with an EFP is that you put copper on the inside or some other type of metal, but preferably copper. And what that does is that then creates this really intensely dense ball. And that ball is projected at incredibly high speeds. And when it hits the side of an unarmed vehicle, the resulting kinetic experience that occurs, one, because it's traveling so fast and so dense, it will go through literally any armor we had at the time. I don't know about the armor now, but certainly at the time then, it would go through anything we had, including our vehicles that were specially designed to defeat IEDs. It would go through our tanks. I mean, it would do whatever it needed to do. And then when it punched through, on the other side, think back to your high school physics, the resulting kinetic explosion on the inside of the vehicle, the result of that dense mass traveling at such a dense speed and the energy that it put out when it comes basically in contact with that armor, it destroys everything inside the vehicle.
Yeah.
And so these were incredibly, incredibly capable pieces of warfare that were used against U.S. forces by the Shia militias. But you're absolutely right, Scott. All of them were built in Iraq. All of them were built by Iraqis. It's not very high technology. All you need is a basic machine shop.
Well, now, wait a minute. Clarify for me, if you could, and I'm sorry, I'm so short on time here to do this to you this way, but can you just clarify for me exactly what you know about these EFPs or, you know, toward debunking the narrative as you're just talking about, but from your personal experience or first or secondhand knowledge from your time either deployed in Iraq or working for this organization back home about it and privy to intelligence about it back then. Is what you read my blog entry at antiwar.com, or you know this because you were there?
Oh, I know this because I was there.
But I mean, just now you said you were in AMBAR. So I'm just saying, clarify as much as you can how you know what you know about this.
So when I was in AMBAR, though, because we were responsible, I was the combat engineer officer for the regimental combat team out there. I was responsible for doing the counter IED work among my responsibilities. So I was involved with all the IED intelligence for all of Iraq during my time there. So even though we didn't have these EFPs in Anbar, certainly I was reading the intelligence that was coming out of Baghdad, say, that was talking about these, that was describing these. And I was thanking, you know, the times I've prayed in my life, thinking that the Sunnis weren't picking up on this, right? Because it would have been really bad for us, just as it was bad for those guys in Baghdad. So, but then when I go to Jaido, I am sitting there, and I didn't work on defeating EFPs. I worked on counter-suicide bombers, but the guys who worked on the EFPs were literally two chairs away from me. And we all read the same intelligence. We all went to the same briefings. You know, anytime, as you described, Scott, one of these workshops was captured. You know, when we had a raid and we found a workshop where they were making the EFPs, we saw the photos, we saw the intelligence, we read the reports, you know, and again, none of it came from Iran. It was all built.
None of it. From quote you, none.
Why would they have it? You're talking about copper, you're talking about metal casing, and you're talking about explosives, which there is so much explosives in Iraq, as everyone knows, because, you know, Saddam's military was the fifth largest in the world, you know, thanks to the United States helping to build it up in the 80s and everything else. And we go in there, we didn't secure. I can talk about, I mean, Scott, we could be here all day, but I could talk about seeing ammunition supply points, you know, where that were just, you know, as literally almost to the horizon, full of weapons, munitions, explosives that were unguarded.
Man, you know, you've got to write a book about Iraq War,
you know,
too.
I'm talking about being there after a year, they're still unguarded. You and I could have gotten our little Toyota pickup truck, driven out there, taken whatever we want, You know, and so why would they have to bring anything in from Iran? Everything was right there. And the material needed to create these, it's like a, you know, it's simple. What you, it drill presses and you know, I'm not I don't know that type of engineering, but like, it's simple stuff. If you have if you have a shop, you can do this. And once you figure it out, once you have an idea, and what we'd find is that they would, you know, they have facilities to, make them more accurate. They have facilities to counter any of the counters that we put out, anything that we put out to try and defeat these IEDs. Within 30 days, they put out a counter to that. They found a way to try and defeat it or were, yeah, I mean, so like, but again, getting back to the main point though, yeah, this argument that just as they're saying Soleimani was planning an imminent strike, just as they said, Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, just as they said the Taliban was involved with 9/11, just as they said that the Spanish blew up the Maine, you know, it's all garbage. All garbage. And this idea that the Iranians are personally responsible for the deaths, the people who are responsible for those 600 people dead is George Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld
and Joe Biden. You
know, and Joe Biden, exactly. And Hillary Clinton, you know, I mean, that's who's responsible. And who's responsible for this mess now is Barack Obama, because he let his CIA and his Pentagon and his people start arming, via the Turks and the Saudis again and everything, start arming ISIS in Syria, because they thought they could use ISIS against Assad, and somehow ISIS would not cross the border over to Iraq, that imaginary line in the sand, and do anything in Iraq. I mean, the people who are responsible for all this are living very good lives in the United States right now, lives where they are celebrated, they go on the Ellen DeGeneres show, whatever. They're the ones who are responsible for those 600 men and women who are dead, for the anguish of those families, for the 7,000 killed, for the, you know, 9,000 who's committed suicide, for the God knows how many contractors have been killed, and then for literally the millions of people killed from Libya east to Pakistan. You know, those are the men and women responsible, not the government of Tehran, not the government of Iraq, not the government of, you know, wherever.
Yeah. All right, you guys, that is the great Matthew Ho. He is from the Center for International Policy. And I'll urge you guys to go back and Google his name in the year 2009 in Afghanistan and see about his great, courageous whistleblowing and trying to stop Obama from doubling the Afghan war back then. Really great stuff. And you can read about him in my book, Fool's Errand, too. Thank you very much, Matthew. Appreciate it.
All right, thanks, Scott. Appreciate it, man.
The Scott Horton Show, Anti-War Radio, can be heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., APSradio.com, antiwar.com, scotthorton.org, and libertarianinstitute.org.